Hi, everybody. How are you? Welcome to the Other People Show. My name is Brad Listy, and I'm in Los Angeles. It's nice to be with you. I hope you're doing okay wherever you are. I have on the program today Lana Bastashich. Her debut novel, Catch the Rabbit, is available now in translation from Restless Books. Catch the Rabbit is the official June pick of the Nervous Breakdown Book Club. TheNervousBreakdown.com is my online culture magazine and literary community. It has its own monthly book club. If you want to sign up for that, just go to TheNervousBreakdown.com. Catch the Rabbit is the winner of the 2020 European Union Prize for Literature. Lana Bastashich is a Yugoslav-born writer, and when I spoke with her, she was in Switzerland, where she's been doing a residency for the past several months, working on her next book. And I really enjoyed meeting her and talking with her, and I really enjoyed this novel. It's an excellent book about two old friends who are reunited, and they go on the road to Vienna. That's a really simple way of putting it. It's a road novel. It's a novel about memory, childhood, the past, the people who show us who we are and who we wish we weren't sometimes. just wonderfully done. And I'm very pleased to get to share this conversation with you. Perhaps this is your introduction to Lana Bastashich and Catch the Rabbit. I think you're in for a treat. So let's get to it. Here she is, folks. This is Lana Bastashich and her debut novel, her award-winning debut novel, one more time, is called Catch the Rabbit.
I decided that I would analyze, in a way, the 12 chapters of Alice's Adventures in Wonderland, which is the first Alice book, and then try to mirror those 12 chapters with my own story, which is mostly set in Bosnia. And at first, it was just this kind of fun idea you have as a writer, like, okay, this could be a cool experiment. And then parallel to that, I had this idea of writing a road trip novel about my country that would somehow tell the story of my country, but I didn't quite, you know, have all the ingredients yet. And then once I kind of brought the two of those things together, it just kind of made sense that I would have this 12 chapter narrative that I would mirror Alice, not just because it's fun, but also because I think on some level, being a little girl in Bosnia in the 90s is similar to Alice's experience, you know, being dragged from her safe Victorian existence into Wonderland, which is actually quite dark and violent when you think about it. And there's always the question of who are you? So I thought this would be a nice parallel to draw between these two stories and also give my story a kind of fantastical element. Instead of just writing, you know, another war book.
Okay, so the first part of that is of interest to me because I think it's a sometimes overlooked, maybe just by me, strategy when you're trying to think of how to structure a novel or tell a story, is to find some sort of precedent or, you know, even like you're working with a fairy tale or a children's book, which is at a remove from the kind of book that you were trying to write, and yet you were using it as a kind of framework or inspiration for your own. I want to say just yesterday was thinking of trying to do something similar for like a quasi crime novel that I'm pondering, but I have no idea how to write. So that's I think that's a nice thing to do. It's not like to imply that one should plagiarize, but I think you can look to other books as precedent in terms of how the story is built together, and you can almost, it's almost like you can volley with it or work off of it without feeling like too untethered.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, it's not to me, I don't think of literature as a series of patents, or it's not physics. You go to literature and you see what is useful to you to tell your story. And of course, to me, the biggest inspiration was what James Joyce did with the Odyssey. So you have this myth, this great ancient Greek myth of this great hero, and then you have this no man in Dublin, the beginning of the 20th century, who's not remarkable in any way, and he's going to be his Odysseus, Joyce's Odysseus. And I just thought, this is lovely. It's like, nobody can say that Joyce plagiarized the Odyssey. And he was actually trying to say something about his own country. So this is what I wanted to do, it's just to use these symbols, which already exist in readers' minds, universally. I think Alice is such a universal story, to use them to actually say something about Bosnia and about, being a little girl there.
And then the second piece of the puzzle is this this desire to write a road novel. This is very much a road trip novel. I love those kinds of stories. I like road travel, at least in theory. Well, I don't know if I keep talking to my wife about wanting to do a road trip with our kids, and I think that might be I might be romanticizing this. I might be off of that by the time we actually do it and get back home, assuming we do. But in my youth, especially, I could drive forever. Like, I love just getting out and exploring. And so I think that when you're talking about wanting to sort of build off of Alice in Wonderland and then combine it with a road novel, that makes a certain sense to me. There's a logic, like a creative logic in it. And I also feel like when I hear stories of how authors put together their books, sometimes it'll be the case that, like you, they'll find a precedent or a book that serves as an inspiration and a kind of sounding board throughout the writing process. But I often also find that people will arrive at some sort of concoction, like they're combining seemingly disparate elements. And once they get those two pieces together, it kind of clicks. Is that the case? Like, once you had those two things, then suddenly you had your bearings.
Yeah, I think that was definitely the case with this novel. I wouldn't, be that arrogant to suggest that everybody should do the same. Everybody has their own way of writing, and a simple storyline is just, can be just as good literature as something more complex. But to me, once I had it, once I saw it, I was like, yes, this is definitely what I want to do, because I have a journey. It was also, less intimidating writing your first novel, and having a kind of outline structure. I just don't think of myself as this, genius who sits down and then the muses sing into my ears and I just pour it all out. I don't believe in that. I think it's hard work. So it was just easier to have an outline and then, work my way through the 12 chapters, and then at the same time have a map, and know exactly where my characters are in the story in each one of the 12 chapters. So, then you just have to sit down and write it.
Right.
Just.
Well, I think too, like knowing where it ends. I've found in trying to write books over the years that like having a sense of an ending is useful, because then at least you're writing towards something. I know sometimes people just like intuit their way from start to finish and have no real idea about the ending until it happens, but I think it's more common to at least have a some sense of where it's going to reach its conclusion, because it's so hard to sustain creative energies over the course of a long, a big book project over a long period of time, that I think sometimes it might get too demoralizing to be lost for that long. You know,
Yeah.
like to have a sense of at least, okay, I know where I'm heading. I'll figure out the details. I don't know. I can totally understand why that would be of comfort, and it would be like a saner way to do it.
Yeah, to me, it's definitely like the most important thing when I'm writing is to know the ending, and to kind of work towards it, because until you have that, you don't really know what your story is about, you know? Sometimes I think otherwise I would be writing and writing and writing and get to the end and then realize, oh my God, this was a completely, this story is not what I thought it was about. It's about something completely else. So it's just a good idea to shape the story so that it kind of arrives at this point. And for me, from the beginning, I knew that it would be this, you know, museum, and there would be exactly the scene that is there. I don't know how much I'm supposed to reveal, but I just had it clear from the beginning, because I think I would. I'm not a mature writer or whatever. I don't have a lot of experience writing. So I think I would just be, you know, going in too many directions, trying too many things, you know, digressing. And I think my story would just kind of get crazy and I would lose track of it. So it was just easier to know where I was heading.
Yeah, I mean, even if, like, in theory, you might have arrived at the same story and written the same book, maybe this way that we're, or this method we're describing, is just more efficient.
Exactly.
You saved yourself a couple of years.
Yeah. At least it's less intimidating, that's for sure.
And you translated this book yourself. Yeah. Now, that's not something I've heard, I don't think, in the history of the show, somebody translating their own work. Maybe there's somebody who's translated their work from English to another language. But can you just talk about that project of translating to English?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, you know, it's not something I would recommend. I think it's definitely better to have somebody else translate your work. I think there needs to be some sort of distance. But the truth is, I mean, if I asked you or your, you know, listeners, how many Bosnian women writers do you know? I'm sure the number would not be great, right? And this has to do with a kind of firewall that we have. And, you know, it's very hard for women writers in Bosnia, in the Balkans in general, to get out there, you know, from, you know, awards, magazines, publishing houses, anything really. And then if you can get there, it's very hard to get translated. So it's like really, really difficult to make it internationally. So what I realized when I finished my first draft, actually, in the original, I realized if I don't do this, it's not going to happen. You know, I will be waiting for somebody to just discover it on their own. But how many people really speak Serbo-Croatian or Bosnian? So I thought, okay, I want to find an agent. I didn't have an agent at that point. And I want to get translated, but I need to have some sort of text that I can show to, you know, French publishers, Spanish publishers, English publishers. So I sat down and I just translated the whole thing. And then it was a really useful thing when it comes to editing, because while translating, I could see certain things that I didn't like, that I thought were redundant, you know. I could kind of weed out all this, you know, dead weight. And then I went back to the original and I edited, you know, from, you know, going back and forth. So it was a really useful process. Of course, time-consuming, incredibly time-consuming, but that's how, in the end, I got an agent, and that's how I got all these, you know, translation deals. Otherwise, I think it would have been, maybe it wouldn't have happened.
So based off of the English translation that you did, that got you other translation rights sold?
Exactly, because, you know, the agent that I found in Barcelona, I was living in Barcelona at that point, he doesn't read Serbo-Croatian, and nobody really does. So it's a catch-22 situation where you need to be translated to get an agent, but in order to be translated, you need an agent.
Right.
So I just realized, yeah, I'm gonna sit down and do this. Maybe it's not gonna be perfect. I just need to have a functional text that I can, you know, show to people. And then what happened is that my editor at Picador said, "Well, we actually like this voice, and we would like to work with this translation." And this was really scary to me. Like, oh my God, really, you're going to do this? I'm not a professional translator, let alone, you know, native speaker of English.
But wait. You speak beautiful English. I've also poked around on the internet preparing for this. Like, you speak, how many languages do you speak?
So I speak 5 languages.
Okay. See, this shames me. I'm an American, like a monolingual American. You speak like fluent Italian. Is that right?
Yeah, Spanish, Catalan, yeah.
God.
No, but the thing is, it's still, I think that when it comes to translation, it's best to have a native speaker because there are some nuances that, you guys know and they come naturally to you and not to me, honestly. But luckily I had a great editor in English, so we managed to, prepare the text for a publication.
I'm going to push back a little bit because I've tried to feature. And by the way, do you know Vesna Meric, Bosnian writer? She lived in Barcelona. I talked to her for this show earlier this year.
There is a Bosnian writer who lived in Barcelona, and I haven't heard of her.
Yeah,
That's
she's still there.
wow, that's uncanny.
Yeah, so when if you go back, I could put you guys in touch. You guys should hang out.
Definitely.
But I think that, you say it's better for somebody else to translate you. As a fan of reading works in translation, and like I've been trying extra hard this year to read outside of like the normal American publishing sphere, just to, I've been joking. I'm just like, I'm very tired of America. I need other voices in my head at this point. But I find that the work of a translator is much like the work of a good editor, undervalued, unseen, doesn't get the credit that it deserves, and matters hugely. If you have a bad translator and they are translating a very good book, they can easily ruin it.
Totally.
And maybe they can elevate a book that would otherwise be not so great. So, what I would argue to you for future books that you might write in your native tongue and then seek to have translated is be very careful because this is a very good translation. And I think whatever blind spots you may have in terms of the vernacular in English, those things can be edited out or can be ironed out with a good editor, but you have no one has better command of your story and the nuances of the characters and the world of your story than you do. So I don't know. If I were you, I might stick to your process that you have here, unless you find a translator who you trust really, really well, because I think this worked out well. I don't know. I didn't find anything lacking in it.
Yeah, well, I'm really happy you say that, but I think having another person translate your work, I think it's more honest because you're really tempted to change things. You think, okay, this is the exact translation, but these languages are so different. They belong to different language families. This would sound better in English. And then, you're tempted to change it, et cetera. So in this way, it's I don't know if it's completely honest. I don't know if you can say it's the same book, but maybe you can't say that about any translation. I still think that definitely, I agree with what you said that translators are terribly underrated. And this was the case, for example, with Virginia Woolf in former Yugoslavia. Those first translations were terrible. They were so terrible that Virginia Woolf had almost no readers. In Yugoslavia, so it took like years and years, decades for her to get readers, and it was the translator's fault. So, I think we tend to overlook this, and especially we tend to forget that English is kind of, colonizing the whole global literary scene, if it exists, and this idea that you either exist in English or you don't exist. So, we really should encourage translators and pay them well, and especially from these so-called small languages, because there aren't that many.
Yeah, and I feel like American publishing houses need to do a better job of publishing works in translation. There are presses like Restless, there are Archipelago Books does a lot of great translations, but it doesn't happen often enough in American publishing. And I don't know, I feel like committed to reading cross-culturally like going forward. This isn't just like it doesn't feel like a temporary experiment or temporary phase, in my reading. I kind of started this year like kind of a New Year's resolution, like I'm going to read more works in translation. And now I'm just into it. I don't see it ending anytime soon. I feel like it's a much richer reading experience. And it just, I don't get to travel the way that I wish I could. And it's a nice way. Like I went to Vienna, as far as I'm concerned, after reading your book. It's the next
Yeah.
best thing.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, I have to say, since I majored in English, I had the same problem, which is that I read mostly English and American writers. in original. And then I also made this resolution of, okay, for Christ's sake, you're like a Slavic writer. You cannot do this. You owe it to this legacy, the great Slavic legacy. At least go to the Russians, start there. And I had to make this. And now, whenever I travel, when I go, for example, I was in Budapest recently. So I went to a bookshop. I don't speak Hungarian,
Yet,
obviously. I don't know how
yet.
anybody can. But I went to an English bookstore and I asked them, okay, give me Hungarian writers that I, must read, that I can't say I have not read. And that was a great experience, and then, talking to the bookseller. And so now I'm trying this, visiting, going to cities and then trying to read locally. And I'm really happy about it, yeah.
So I want to ask you a little bit about before we talk more about your book, I want to learn a little bit more about your personal history growing up in the former Yugoslavia. You seem young, so I'm trying to place you in the country's history, like with respect to your childhood experiences. Like where were you? Like how, with respect to the war and the aftermath and your personal experience.
Yeah, so I was born in 1986, which is, the year of the Chernobyl. And which is 6 years after the death of Tito, the dictator, or the president of Yugoslavia. And then I was about five when the war started, which means that I'm a bit younger than my characters. It was a choice. I wanted them to remember things better than I do. And then I was around nine when the war stopped. And I grew up, so I was born in Zagreb, which is the capital of Croatia. But already in the late 80s, there was this policy of, ethnically cleansed or clean or whatever, Croatia. So non-Croats were, suffering under a lot of pressure to leave. So my family left Zagreb and we went to Bosnia because my grandparents were there. And I mean, now, in hindsight, it sounds like the dumbest place to go in the 90s. But the truth is, back then, a lot of people, including my parents, really saw that there's no chance there would be a war. It's just like today, people, like in Switzerland, people would say there's no way wherever. Like that was that kind of, thinking. It's just not going to happen. So we were in Bosnia and the war started. And we stayed there, and I grew up in Banja Luka, which is it's a city in northern Bosnia with a majority of Serbian population. So I could see, with this kind of strange, moving, strange family history, I could see both sides. I could see what it's like to be, not wanted somewhere because of your ethnicity. And then I moved somewhere and I could see what it's like to be part of the majority and to be privileged because you're not a minority. So I had these both, perspectives. And this is something I wanted to include in the novel. This is why, two characters have two different ethnicities. So I could kind of explore this theme further.
So, as a child with the war going on and you were in Banja Luka, like how close was the war to your day-to-day existence? Were there things that you saw as a child that most children don't see, or were you insulated from it?
Well, it's strange when you are five and then there's this thing going on, and you're practically just, developing, cognitive abilities or, making memories, whatever. To you, that's the default mode. It's just how the world works. There's no electricity, and that's normal. We can only have food that doesn't have to be refrigerated, and that's normal. We have to bring wood to our school, because you know we have to, there's no electricity, we're going to be cold, you know, there's this what do you call it, a wooden
Wood burning stove.
exactly a wood burning stove. So it's like all these things, but to you they're normal, you know. So it was actually later when they told us, oh, you know, they're signing the peace agreement. And we were like, oh my God, what does that mean? What's going to happen to us? You know, because it's just you're used to this other thing. But the truth is, I had a very privileged childhood. My city didn't see much war. And I had a privileged childhood because I had the right name, and the right time, and the right place. And this is something I wasn't aware of until much later. You know, where I could see, I could, for example, compare the demographics before the war and after the war and see how, you know, how much Muslim population had to leave or, you know, went missing and how it changed. But back then to us, it was just it was just normal. Yeah.
So you're burning, you had a wood burning stove in your school?
Yeah, and you had to bring your own, what do you call it?
Logs?
Kindling.
Kindling? Wait, yeah. was there one wood-burning stove for each student, or was there just one in the room for the whole?
Oh, God, no, one in the room.
Okay, yeah. Okay, good. I was trying to, that's a lot of stoves.
Yeah, but you know, when you're a kid, it's like, you don't think like, oh my God, this is terrible. We're children. We're going to be cold. You think like, I'm going to bring the most, you know?
Right.
They're
going to
say, wow, she's a girl, but she's so strong. You know, it's like you turn everything into a game. I think it was much harder for our parents because they knew the better times, you know. They remembered the heyday of Yugoslavia where everybody had everything and education was for free and health care was for free. And, you know, they were just happy. Of course, they are also idealizing it. It was, you know, a communist dictatorship, but they didn't suffer in any way. So to them, I think it was much more heartbreaking to see, you know, their kids, you know, having to go through all this. But to us, it was just, we just accepted it as that's what it is.
Yeah, no, it's interesting to countenance that against my experiences in America over the past few years, and also as a parent with young children in something of a similar mode where there's all this chaos and menace, you know, happening in our country and in our government. And yet you're trying to kind of put on a brave face for your kids. You're obviously not going to bring them into the living room and watch the news with them. And, you know,
oh God.
Yeah. You know, you're trying to kind of insulate them. My daughter's now 10 and she's pretty perceptive. So she picks stuff up. But this brings me to my question for you as a person who was like 5 years old when the war started. Is that what you said?
Yeah, exactly.
I understand how the resilience of childhood, you know, how kids just kind of roll with the punches and accept their reality much better than adults, you know. In a way, it's kind of your good fortune that you were a child when this happened, because I think kids tend to handle things better than adults in a lot of ways. But I'm wondering if, with the benefit of hindsight, you're able to understand in yourself as presently constituted things that might have found their way into you, things that you might have absorbed as a child intuitively. Like, because to be surrounded by all of those adults who are weathering a war and who are remembering the old days and who are sad because they're witnessing the, you know, a lot of human failure. It's impossible to think that a child, especially a perceptive child, wouldn't pick up on that stuff. You know, I worry about that with my kids. Like, what is my, especially my daughter, I'm like, what is she, how is she going to process all of this? Or how is she processing all of this? And what's it going to mean to her 15, 20 years from now? Like, do you have a sense of that in yourself after the fact?
Yeah, definitely. I think we kind of underestimate kids and their perceptive abilities. I'm lucky enough to have my diaries. I actually started keeping a diary when I was around 7, And I've never stopped. So it's really strange to read, you know, it's written in this voice of a child, of a 7-year-old kid, an 8-year-old kid, and just to see how much I actually figured out, but then also to see how much I didn't. And it's interesting also because somehow children always think that they're to blame for a lot of things, that it's somehow their fault. So, you know, if your parents are obviously, if they're dealing with all of this, you know, your dad is away somewhere, fighting or not fighting. Your mom is trying to make do with what she has at home, you know, and she has 3 kids. Of course, they're not going to be like the most loving, understanding parents. They have like a bigger fish to fry, right? But you know, you think, no, it's something I did. It's my fault. So this was really, I mean, it was heartbreaking for me to read. But I also loved the how somehow this naive way of looking at things was somehow more honest. You know, things that, for example, to give you an example, it was completely normal to adults that, you know, a child would change, have his or her name changed because they had the wrong, let's say, the wrong ethnicity. You know, so a Muslim name would become a Christian name. So they just accepted it as something that you have to do. Whereas to a child, this was just completely crazy. Like, what do you mean? You can change your name, you know? We didn't realize that it happened because of nationalism, because of, you know, xenophobia, because of hatred. But, you know, we just thought this is ridiculous, you know, one day you're called this and the next day you're called that. And actually, that way, you know, the way a child thinks is true because it is ridiculous. It
Right.
shouldn't be normal,
Yeah,
right?
their instincts are
So at
correct.
that point, yeah, exactly. It was somehow, this is why it reminded me of Alice. Because Alice finds herself in this, you know, country or land where there's this crazy logic. It's not that there's no logic, there is a logic, but it's completely, you know, it doesn't make any sense to her. People just make up rules, you know. You cannot testify in court because you're not tall enough, things like that. So this is what it felt like to us also. Like, this doesn't make any sense.
Yeah, I can totally relate. I'm living in a country that doesn't make, I guess, you know, what country does make sense when you look at it under a magnifying glass? But I think there are certainly eras or periods of time where things get particularly illogical. And I find it stressful to consider, like to pay attention to it, to actually try to monitor what's happening in real time with some clarity, and to watch the craziness unfold, and then to watch, I think watching the craziness unfold is one thing, but to then witness like a huge swath of the population not having any problem with it. Like that's the part that it becomes so disorienting, is you feel like, I'm surrounded by people who think this is real or don't care or are just not paying any attention. And that part of it is what gets so alarming.
Yeah, I guess we are like witnessing this major lack of empathy more than ever. I don't know if it has to do with this, you know, age of hyper individualization and social media where it's all, you know, me, myself, and I. And I can only talk and write about myself, and I'm only interested in myself. I don't know if it has to do with that. I'm not a philosopher. But you know, there's just this lack of empathy. And I think this is what children have, and this is why we have, you know, a preteen or a teenager, you know, at the head of the climate change, you know, battles. And because I think a kid is going to call you out, you know, on certain things, racism, you know, climate change. A kid, you know, show a kid a picture of a refugee in a boat. And the kid is going to say, why don't you help this person? You know, they're just naturally, they're going to, I don't want to idealize them. Like, there are some really terrible kids out there, but I think they're going to react, you know, whereas the adult is going to try to rationalize, to explain. And usually this is not going to, you know, be full of empathy.
You know, I'm thinking about the Americanization of the world, like global hegemony and or hegemony, and you know, you talked about it in publishing. You were just mentioning, you know, the way that English language publishing is has a kind of colonizing aspect. And I read a story in the news just the other day about how France is becoming, you know, France is forever bemoaning how it's becoming more and more American. You know, there's always that resistance to wanting to preserve its own culture, which I think is the right instinct. But I worry about this notion of hyper-individualization. I mean, these social media companies originated in the United States, did they not? And okay. I had a conversation on this show with a writer named Jared Kobeck, who lives here in LA and is a pal of mine. And he makes the point, which I think is overlooked a lot of the time when we talk about social media, is that these platforms were built by men. They were. And it's one thing to say, well, they have the money and the power and they own these companies, but they also wrote the code. They also made decisions about how the platforms behave in large part. I know there are women who work for these companies too, but the majority is nerdy dudes. And I think we should think more about what that means. In what are its implications? Are these guys, you know, like the libertarian tech bro kind of archetype? You know, how pervasive was that at the origins of these platforms, and what are the implications of it? Like, that kind of trips me out, but you're never gonna catch me arguing in defense of social media companies. I can't say social media is a bugaboo for me, and to the point where I fear that my listeners are like, oh god, here he goes again. The cranky middle-aged man railing against Twitter. But it's partially because I've read a lot about it, and I feel like I've learned a lot about how toxic and, I don't know, just wrongheaded a lot of it is. But also because I was a Twitter addict in the extreme. Yeah. So I'm not speaking from some, you know.
It's very addicting, yeah.
Yeah. So I've lived it. I'm like a junkie in recovery. And now, you know, I'm railing against it.
But to me, you know, the scariest thing about these social networks is this creation of bubble society. You know, that you think, you know, you open, I don't know, Twitter or whatever you have, Facebook, Instagram, and you think, I'm out there, you know, I'm talking to the world, where actually you're just talking to a bubble, and this bubble is based on your consumer behavior, you know, because we are just somewhere, you know, somewhere in some marketing agency, you are the type for some product, you know, exactly you. The cranky, what did you say, middle-aged social networks hating guy, you are the consumer for something, you know. So it's like we've created these bubbles and we think that we are, you know, out there, that we understand the world, but actually we don't. It's just a society full of mirrors, and this is what scares me. And I think that also has to do with this lack of empathy. Somebody once said, like, the most subversive thing you can do today is like a post on Instagram that has nothing to do with you, that you don't even like, that, you know, none of your followers follow. Like, step out of the game, you know, just disturb the pattern.
Well, I was going to say, mess with the algorithm.
Exactly, mess with the algorithm, yeah.
I mean, if you want, because you talk about the dangers, or, you know, like this bubble society that it creates, like, and then you talk about the former Yugoslavia, or you talk about contemporary America and how balkanized, you know, to use like a apt word or whatever, things have become, how tribalized. This is what happens with social media algorithms reinforcing people's biases, is that it gives you this impression that you're out there getting the news and commiserating with the world, when all that you're really doing is being fed stories and opinions that reinforce your biases and agitate you, which keeps you on the platform. And, you know, I've said this many times before, it always bears repeating, like, you're their mark. That's how they make money, is by keeping your eyeballs glued. And they figured out that by keeping you like afraid and pissed off, you're going to tune in more often. And so I think that it increases a sense of tribalization, whether you realize it or not. And it desecrates, and it has, you know, it's impressive work, really, when you think about the fact that these companies have only been around for, you know, 15 years, really.
Yeah, but Brad, we did the work.
I know.
That's the scary thing.
Yeah, we work for them. Yeah, we work for them.
Exactly.
But I'm
Yeah,
just saying that.
filling out those profiles and opening those things and posting. We are doing the work because we love the mirror.
Right.
We love to see ourselves, you know? It's genius in a way. It's terrible, but
Yeah,
that's why it works.
that's right. And it just desecrates a sense of shared civic identity. I think that's what it's done in a large part here at home, I'm sure around the world. And I don't know what the solution is. I don't think they're going anywhere, but I think there has to be some sort of changes, you know, some significant changes made to keep these things from becoming hypertoxic. I want to talk to you. You mentioned changing names as a way of protecting one's children in the former Yugoslavia. And in your story, there are two principal characters. This is a story, I know this reduces it, but it's a story of two female friends. I don't know how tired you are of hearing it talked about that way. It's the female friendship road novel, but
Yeah,
you know, we always need a shorthand.
of
But
course.
you have Sarah, and then you have, and help me with the pronunciation. Is it Layla?
It's like the Clapton song.
Okay, I got it right then.
Layla.
I'm proud of myself for having been saying that
Very good.
as I was reading. But there is the original spelling, which is Lejla.
Yeah.
And then it is in the story, she changes it to Lela, which is, I guess, the more Christian spelling.
Yeah, I know it sounds ridiculous and it is ridiculous, but Layla is an Arabic name. It means night. So it's in Bosnia, you know, if you have that name, you're immediately associated with Islam, even though if you're not a practicing Muslim, it doesn't really make any difference. Whereas Layla is a Serbian Christian name. So just taking one letter out. You know, you turn, or at least like you seem, to have changed your religion, your group, your social group, your ethnicity, everything.
One letter.
One letter,
That's a that
exactly.
is absurd, right?
It's completely absurd. And I mean, there were a lot of, when I was growing up, I remember kids, you know, coming to school just one day. And we would be told, okay, his name from now on, his name is whatever, you know, Marco, which is like Mark, like Christian name, Petar, which is like Peter, you know, and it used to be whatever, Muslim name. And I remember thinking, what? That doesn't make any sense. And you know, we just had to accept it. And like, we knew that we shouldn't talk about it. And it was, you know, it wasn't until years later, looking back, that I realized, oh my God, this was just ethnic cleansing. This was, you know, people, this was a matter of life and death, just parents making this choice. And then I asked myself, what happens to a 10-year-old, you know, like your daughter, you know, 11-year-old? Somebody comes to her and tells her, okay, from now on, you're called whatever, Christina. Don't tell me her name is
No.
Christina. You know, like what happens to your sense of identity, to your self, sense of self? You know, I mean, it shatters. It's very hard to later on to build any sense of self, I think. And this was happening on a large scale in Bosnia in the 90s.
I can imagine as a parent trying to make it into a game,
Yeah.
just to try to help it make sense to your kid, like as a protective kind of impulse. But what a sad thing to have to do.
Exactly, yeah.
Okay, so your book is about, just to give listeners who haven't had a chance to read, kind of a
It's
general
not about
idea.
social networks.
No, it's not about Facebook, thank God. But why don't you, can, I mean, I know this is maybe the worst question to ask a novelist, but you've done enough interviews at this point. Can you sum it up in a couple of sentences? I could do it, but I'd prefer to have
Yeah,
the author take it on.
this is also such an American thing. I recently also had an interview for some American bookstore, and they told me like, "Tell us about your book in, you know, less than a minute." It just sounds like
Yeah. Can you get this
like
over with, please?
It was a talent show or something, you know? It's so anti-European, you know, like, because we don't have time. We have to be productive. We are Americans. We only have a minute for you. But so, you know, it's always hard for me to do it. And then I would say, well, it's orange and the letters are blue. You know? But yeah, so basically it is a book about two women who grow up together in war-torn Bosnia and years later are reunited to go on a journey to Vienna. And during this journey, there's a lot of flashbacks to their shared shared childhood. So this is normally what I say.
No, that's great.
I avoid the word friendship because I think it's such a complex relationship that they have. I feel like we lack words for friendships, all different kinds of friendships that people can have, and 'cause what they have is at times very toxic, competitive. At times, it's almost like sisterhood. So whenever I hear, you know, two friends, I'm just not sure about that yet.
Do you have relationships like this, or a relationship like this?
Well, you know, I kind of drew upon a lot of different women in my life, in like different parts of my childhood. But I have to say, I'm lucky not to have this kind of thing in my life, because I think by the end of the book, well, I don't want to spoil it, but I think they need each other. I think there's a learning process that's important, especially for Sarah. I think there's an education there, but I also think there's an end, and I think there has to be one.
What, an end to the relationship?
Maybe. I don't know. What do you think?
I don't know. This is what I stay up at night thinking about. What happened? okay. So I don't want to get too gendered in my like proclamations, but I think that female friendship tends to be different than male friendship. Sometimes in good ways, sometimes in bad ways. I think as I'm listening to you talk, I'm thinking of my daughter just like on the cusp of adolescence and how intense her girl friendships have gotten, or some of them have gotten at school, to the point where, like, you know, school just ended here, like the spring semester just ended. So they broke into summer and they have these like end of year parties. And my wife took...
That's a big deal.
Yeah, it's a big deal. It's like swimming and, you know, boys and girls and the whole thing. And one of them like ran into the night. I'm at home with our younger child, so I'm not there. My wife comes home and she's like describing this like girl fight that happened. And our daughter was sort of in the middle. And then like one of the moms like had a couple of glasses of wine and is like, you know, you guys need to, like, there was like this big shouting resolution and there's tears. And I'm just like, oh my God, you know. But I also grew up with sisters. And then I also watch the ways in which my wife and her friends build and maintain friendships. Those are healthy. My wife is not, you know, she doesn't have a lot of dramatic friendships in that mode, but I think it sometimes happens, especially in adolescence. What I would say about guys, especially as a grown man, is that we're just terrible at being friends with anybody. Like, guys have their own set of problems. It just seems different. Like, I have a hard time making friends, like doing, like, we don't do anything together. Like, women talk and like support one another, and guys are just like, hey, you know, like maybe you watch like a game with them or something, you know, that's about as far as it goes. But I think that the Sarah and Layla, Sarah's the protagonist of your book and the narrator, but the Sarah Layla relationship is a really deftly drawn, portrait of just how complex and multifaceted female friendship is, but also childhood friendship. Like those deep, yep, deeply rooted childhood friendships, they're impossible to replicate. I don't care how close you become to somebody later in your life. Like, you can develop a great deep friendship with somebody in your adult years. It's never quite the same as the one you formed with somebody when you were like 10, you know?
Yeah, exactly. I mean, when it comes to female friendship, I have to say, I mean, at least in Bosnia, and I think it's the same in the rest of the world, unfortunately, these are forged in really heavy patriarchy. And we are taught from a very young age that our main goal is to compete for male attention. And, you know, we're going to get validation if we are seen and acknowledged by a man. So immediately you tend to see other women as competition. And there's this, you know, culture in Bosnia. This is why a lot of us growing up, I talked to my friends about this. We had internalized misogyny, you know, where you would say, I don't hang out with girls. I only, you know, my best friends are boys, you know, and that's like a good thing because that's like real friendships and girls are trivial. I mean, it's you know, internalized misogyny. It's like hating your own sex or thinking it's not, you know, serious enough because they're your competition and you're supposed to beat them for male attention. And you know, having a friendship develop in this kind of environment, it's gonna be very complex. It's gonna be hard. It's gonna be difficult. You're constantly, you know, comparing yourself to this other person, copying this other person. And I remember this. So of course, some of those friendships survived, and we learned to, you know, we actually unlearned a lot in order to first see each other as, you know, human beings who can talk about something other than men, you know, and we do talk about things other than men. But it took a lot of work. I think things are changing now. I can see that things are changing, and I'm happy that they are. But it was really, really like that. It just they were your competition, you know. Even I think in the media, also a lot of American movies that, of course, we were bombarded with, especially after the fallout of Yugoslavia. It was just suddenly, you know, English everywhere. But it was, you know, you have the popular girl and then her ugly friends, you know, and it was like, why? This is terrible, you know.
Right.
So yeah, I mean, this is something that I wanted to explore. And when it comes to children and what you said, childhood friendships, I think we as adults, we tend to dismiss all of, I think, their experience, not just friendships, as, you know, less important, trivial, not gonna last. You know, even when they fall in love or whatever, we see it as not that important. But then you realize this is their whole life. This is their universe. And in their universe, that's the friend, that's the crush, that's the villain, that's the, you know, ally, whatever. It's like it's so important to them. And I do think there's something special about those friendships. Like when you're a kid, you can come to your friend and say, you know, okay, you stink today. You know,
Yeah.
and that's gonna be okay, you
Right,
know,
right.
or you know, I don't like you. You know, what you said is stupid. You know, it's like there's like this brutal honesty, like all those layers and layers, like Victorian layers would come later. So I do think those friendships are special, and I'm pretty sure that whatever fight your daughter had or was part of, I'm pretty sure it was a very big deal to them.
Yeah, no doubt, no doubt. And you know, trying to like parent through that, I don't know. I hope I do the right thing. Because I think maybe there is like, there's a part of me that can trivialize things because my memory of my, you know, childhood memories, like some of them stand out. Me, I don't have a great memory. Like, I don't remember a single day of high school practically. Maybe some certain instances, but
Maybe that's good.
yeah, that's what I'm saying. And so I can sometimes, my daughter will come home crying and I'll be like, don't worry about it. You'll never remember this in 20 years. And she's like, Dad, that's not helping me.
Yeah, exactly. You can't. I mean, to her, it's important. It's now. It's happening now.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
So I'm also thinking of that trope, you know, the guy's girl trope. Like she's a girl that can hang with the guys, like you were talking about. I feel like I'm kind of the guy that hangs with girls. Maybe I got problems. You know, I have guy friends, but if I've said this before, but if I'm at a party, I tend to be sitting with women. I prefer the company of women to men if I had to choose. And not just like as a sexual being or whatever, you know, like I'm just talking about as like conversational company. Maybe that's 'cause I was raised with sisters. Is there something wrong? Is there a red flag we need to discuss here?
No, I don't think so. But it's funny because we also have this very strong segregation in Bosnia. Like if you have, I don't know, my niece, for example, she celebrated her 11th birthday recently. And then, you know, parents came with kids and the mothers and the fathers just kind of naturally, it's like Moses had appeared and just separated them. You know, so they just, mothers went to one side of the room and the fathers to another one. It was really, really funny because I was there with a friend, a male friend who is Catalan, who is really like the least Bosnian person you can imagine. And he kind of came, you know, to our table because he knew me. So he was like, he decided to, and then, you know, he completely messed up with this kind of, it was also like a National Geographic documentary about, you know, male and female behavior. And then all the men were like confused, like, oh, but like, is like, should we also go there? What should we do? He's there now. He's cool. They're laughing. What is he talking about?
Right.
And then suddenly, you know, thanks to him, the whole group kind of got mixed up. And it was like a little revolution.
That's what needs to happen. I mean,
exactly.
You know.
And then we had fun. We had a lot of fun. I mean, so yeah. You should be that guy, Brad.
I'll be the bridge. I'm gonna, you know, I don't want to be like the weirdo, and they're all like thinking like, well, why is he can't hang with us? But it's just, this is what I would say. I think the conversation is more interesting. I like good conversations, and that isn't to say that I can't have good conversations with guys. I just think in social contexts, maybe it's a Los Angeles thing, but I think it's just a guy American thing. The guys are going to talk about sports, or they're going to be like talking about work and trading like war stories from work and like kind of subtly like mentioning their successes. You know what I'm saying? It's just like, ugh, I can't even. Yeah. The women tend to be funnier and just more personal and more interesting. Not always, but most of the time in general. So I think I gravitate towards that. I also think maybe I'm not an alpha male. And so I'm like, okay, I just need to go over here and sit down. I'm not going to win this competition. I don't even want to compete in this conversation about like how many deals you made or, you know what I'm saying? I just can't even do it. So I just retreat.
Yeah, I understand that. But I mean, it's always hard to generalize, but I guess definitely we have, you know, throughout time, we have been assigned these roles and kind of, it was our thing. It was like a woman's thing to, you know, talk, to discuss feelings, emotions, deep stuff, whatever. So maybe we just got better at it, you know, just talking stuff out.
That's what it is. It's like, it feels, it's not even gendered really to me. It's just that it's more human. It's like, oh, okay. So I want to like find out what's going on with people. So if it's a guy I don't care if it's a guy or a girl or whatever, you know, just as long as someone's talking to me, it's like, okay, now we're on some ground that feels real. And the rest of it just feels like kind of like rote. And, you know, it's like you're just going through the motions. It's not like, it's almost like insulting to a degree. And I do it too sometimes. Like I hate when I catch myself in those sorts of lazy habits of conversation. Especially in social situations where I might have to make an effort to extend myself in the direction of somebody I either don't know at all or don't know well.
Yeah.
I think it's harder work to get human, but it's work worth doing. And sometimes I'll catch myself just being like, so what do you do? Or, you know, just making some bullshit joke that I've made a million times. And I try to get myself out of that so that we can actually have a real exchange, you know?
Yeah.
And, it always goes better when I do that.
I think it's always good to break the ice with something completely inappropriate and then, you know, jump over like 20 steps in any relationship and then you're fine.
Yeah. I mean, there's nothing better than being around somebody who says something inappropriate.
Yeah.
But honest. I think it takes everybody's guard down. I love being around people like that, you know, who have, exactly. It's a kind of social grace in a way.
Yeah.
And I think that, I don't know. I you know, I wish I were more that person. Sometimes I can be that person. I guess we all can in our best, you know, in our best moments. But I find that, I've gotten worse. Have you gotten better socially as you've gotten older? I feel like we all degrade really? In some way. Yeah. I feel like I've just gotten worse.
I realized that, you know, we were talking about like female friendship and this, but I've recently realized I just feel much more comfortable having, you know, a one-on-one interaction, a meaningful conversation with someone.
Right. Here we are.
Actually having a conversation, then, you know, being at a party with 50 people and just, you know, small talk and nothing. I just feel tired. I feel exhausted. Like there was communication, but nothing really got across. You know, you're not changed in any way. There's like no interaction really. So yeah, I have a lot of these kind of, I don't have like a big group of friends. You know, I have a lot of individuals in my life, and I just cherish those relationships much more.
Yeah, no doubt. And I think too, you know, you talk about the Sarah Layla dynamic in your book, and you talk about childhood friends, and like the depth of those relationships. There's a transparency to it. But I also think for you and for I, but for different reasons, you know, you talk about being born in Zagreb and then moving and, you know, kind of losing a sense of territorial identity or nationalistic identity.
Totally.
Like that lack of solidity is relatable to me just because I moved around a lot as a child. Like I don't have a sense of home.
Exactly.
I live in Los Angeles, but I kind of feel like I could live anywhere versus a person who is kind of born and raised in one place and has that friends and family tie, which is increasingly rare, I think, in this age of, you know, this economic age of remote work and people, you know, it started in the 20th century, but it didn't used to be normal at all for somebody to leave home and move across the country or around the world to go work. Like you were born somewhere, you probably grew up there, you know, your entire childhood, and then you work there or at least close by.
Exactly.
And as like, I can understand the downsides of that, especially if you're someplace that's not so great or that has limited opportunity. But there's a part of me that always envies people who have that grounded sense of identity in place and have those relationships. Like I'm dislocated from all my college friends. None of them except for one live here. I went to college in Colorado. Yeah. I'm dislocated from the towns of my youth and the people that knew me best, except for these few friendships that I've maintained at a distance with great effort over the years, because I want those.
So you need social networks.
Yeah. I need text messages. I need text messages, but even to get people on the phone anymore is a pain in the ass. Nobody even wants to talk on the phone. But the point that I want to make in my like long-winded fashion is that these friendships that we forge in childhood, not only just are deeper because of the timing and the fact that they happen when you're a kid and you're so malleable, but as time progresses, they signify or help you make sense of what home means, and they help you make sense of your own identity in a really deep and important way.
Exactly. I don't think I could put it better myself. I mean, to me, I don't have a sense of home. The country where I was born no longer exists, because technically I was born in Yugoslavia. Technically, the language was called Serbo-Croatian. It no longer exists. Now we have four different names for the same thing. So it's like my sense of where I'm from is really, really complex. And I have three nationalities on paper. I mean, it's ridiculous. So, you know, I always envied somebody who would say, I'm Italian and I speak Italian and I'm from, you know, Padua or whatever.
And like my great, great, great grandfather, you know, like they go back hundreds
exactly,
of years.
Exactly. Like, you see that cherry tree? My grandfather is buried there. You know, it's like this kind of thing.
Right.
Kind of life and death are there. Everything is there. All the stories are there. I don't have that. But yeah, it's precisely this. It's the friends, you know, of course, family, but also these friendships. I feel like I've made friends after 25, 30. But, you know, that one friend who has known you, like, you cannot bullshit them, you know? It's like, you're going to be, don't give me the European writer, in Zurich, I remember you in pink boots dancing to like a terrible song, on your 12th birthday.
Right.
Like these people, they have things on us, and there's some sort of honesty. Like I've seen all of your transformations, I've seen all versions of you, and I've accepted all of them. And there's something very nice, really, really nice there. Just you don't get to be a hypocrite with them, Just they've seen it all.
Yeah, it's that, and then I think too, it's kind of ineffable, but there's a shorthand that you have when you grew up together in the same place. Like a million different references that they could make. You might not have even been there, but you know what they're talking about. You know what I'm saying?
Exactly.
Like that shorthand is irreplaceable.
Yeah, totally. I mean, I recently talked to a writer, a German writer who's from Bosnia and who's a remarkable writer. His name is Sasha Stanišić. He won the most important German award in literature last year. And he's from Bosnia, and we were talking and there were so many references, shared references where you feel like I don't have to explain myself to this person, or some things in my book or even myself or just anything really, like this person gets it. And so it could be somebody even, I could meet somebody from Bosnia 20 years from now, but somebody who had, spent their childhood there at the same time. And we're going to click. I'm sure it's the same for you. Like if you meet somebody who was a kid in your hometown, and you're going to say one name, the name of that drugstore or the name of whatever, he's going to be like, yeah, I know exactly what you mean. So there is a sense of home there. But I think when it comes to Yugoslavia, for a lot of people, there's also a sense of loss of that feeling, a sense of nostalgia. And just, trying to figure out who we are now and where we belong to without falling into just sheer nationalism.
So, yeah, you're kind of a part of, I don't know how, forgive me for not knowing, but how many people in your generation left? There's like a diaspora in Europe of people who have left the former Yugoslavia and are...
Yeah, a lot. It's so funny, when I went to Vienna, for the first time I went there, I was like, oh, maybe I can pick up some German. And then I was walking down the street and everybody was speaking in my language. Everybody was either, Serbian dialect, Bosnian dialect. It was just people who had left during the war. And also here in Switzerland, it's heartbreaking, really. But, construction workers, cleaning ladies, waiters, waitresses, they all, come from Yugoslavia. And somehow it's strange because most of them left during the war. And I can see how they're slowly losing their mother tongue. Because if you don't speak it in 30 years, it's like a muscle, you're going to lose it. So I meet these people, like these Yugoslav ghosts, with this very strange mutilated language. And to me, they're like the best image of that country, of what it is, it just fell apart. And now it's like, just try to find work anywhere else. And, it's slowly losing memory and losing, which is something I wanted to explore in the book too, what it's like to like lose touch with your own mother tongue and what that means.
The book also is about, critically, Layla's brother, and help me with the pronunciation, is it Armin?
Yes, Armin.
Yeah. Armin, yeah. So Armin is Layla's brother. By the way, I should say too, I know Layla's complicated. I love Layla.
And Thank you.
Yeah, here's what I respond to in Layla, because Layla is strong-willed. She's got no filter. I like people, even if they say things that I don't agree with or that might even be offensive in some quarters. There's a certain kind of person. She's drawn very well in your book. But I'd rather be around that person than the person who's sort of passive aggressive and holding
totally
his or her cards close to the vest. And there's a kind of like native or raw intelligence in her, an alpha quality. I don't know. It's weird. It's like, I don't necessarily know if I'd want to be like her. But I find myself admiring people like that to a certain degree because I lack some of those qualities. That sort of, and I think Sarah feels like similarly. She's
exactly.
Maybe it's the writer in me responding to the writer and Sarah. This kind of more inward, timid, uncertain, self-conscious, you know, personality type or wiring, countenanced against Layla, who is brash and maybe not fully in control of her emotional self. And that leads to behavior and expressions of, I don't know, any range of things, fear, disgust, contentment, you know, it comes out in all these different ways, but you feel like it's really her. And often there's a lot of insight in it. I don't know. She's complicated, but she's really lovable.
Well, I'm happy you like her, because when the book came out originally, there were like a lot of readers kind of hating her. She's unbearable. You know, she just does whatever she wants. And then they would side with Sarah. It was almost like a team Layla, team Sarah thing, which to me was just ridiculous. But then I would remind them, you know, you have to remember that you're reading a story from only one point of view. Like, there's one person describing everything. And I deliberately wanted Sarah to be this kind of narrator who's going to, you know, use this flowery language, a lot of metaphors. She's trying to explain everything, to rationalize it, why, you know, with this kind of constantly comparing things to something else, like not being direct, and also fabricating quite a bit. So to, you know, on the other side, to have somebody who speaks directly and who did not have all the privileges that Sarah had, and who just like has seen the other side of life. And to show that these two girls, when they were girls, just because they had different names, their paths were completely different from that day on, you know? And Sarah would have been much different if she had had to suffer all the things that Layla's family had suffered. So, like, Layla's not going to take any bullshit, you know? She's going to see it for what it is and call it, you know, for what it is. And I wanted to have this kind of clash. So I was really sad when people told me they didn't like her. I was like, you know what?
Nonsense. She's kind of like heroic to me in some way. I kind of want to be like her more, but not too much, but in the good ways. And Layla's got a brother named Armin, who is like she was Sarah's crush as a teen, yeah. Right? And so, you know, you talk about the importance of friendships forged in adolescence and in our youth and how, you know, deep those ties are. I mean, I can still remember my junior high school crush. Everybody can, right? You know, those things are indelible. And you do a great job of drawing, you know, the scene, like the pivotal scene in the backyard where they sort of, you know, he's older. How many years older is he?
Yeah, he's 16 there, and Sarah is 12.
Okay, so that's like the age gap where it's like he's. Remember how all powerful somebody who was 16 seemed when you were 12? They seem like adults.
Yeah, to her, he's like a god.
Yeah. So, and then he disappears. You know, he is not a present character in the novel except in memory. And I want to just talk to you a little bit more historically about this kind of eventuality. Like, obviously in a war, young men get killed and bad things happen to men and women, but especially to young men who are out there fighting or whatever. But the character of Armin has sort of vanished, and there's a lot of mystery around what happened to him. Like, from a writerly standpoint, were you drawing on like a lot of precedent or personal experience? Like, how common was it for people to just disappear in that war and in that time?
It was very common. And I mean, Armin and his friends, all of those who had Muslim names, they actually, you know, they were seen as some sort of menace, as the other, you know, pretty much the way we see, you know, young refugee men today. You know, they're here just to you know, I don't know, to harm us in some way or whatever the paranoia is about. You know, it's this idea of creating this this other that we can be afraid of. So a lot of young men went missing and they were never found. Their families never really had a closure. And this was just something that nobody really talked about. Some of them, you know, just escaped, went somewhere else, and some of them were found murdered. And it's terrible. And the weird thing is that it's still, Bosnia is still a place where this can happen for different reasons, usually political reasons. You know, we talk about how, oh, we used to have this communist dictatorship and now there's democracy. Yeah, but these people who are, you know, like the presidents, or whatever, the head of these countries, they were forged in that same system and they haven't changed their modus operandi overnight. So it's the same kind of, you know, dealing with the enemy or whatever the perceived enemy is. So it is something that, and there's this sentence in my language, which is really interesting. They say, there's this phrase, they say, if somebody goes missing, the darkness swallowed him. You know, and it's like, it's such an interesting sentence to me. It was really interesting because like there's no agency there. Like you don't really blame a person, a politician, or the police. No, it's just darkness swallowed him or her. So I wanted to play with that too and to show that. So it wasn't something, you know, I invented because it was a good like plot twist. It was something that actually happened. And then I wanted him to be this 16-year-old god who never really develops as a literary character because he went missing when the narrator was 12. So everything we get from him, it's this dark hole, you know, it's just this place, something that is not there. And then she can idealize him and turn him into something. Probably if she saw the real man, he wouldn't, you know, be exposed to that idea. But then like for the rest of her life, all of her relationships, all of the men that she meets, you know, they can never quite compare. So I think both to, but again, I mean, if you think of this, the different Sarah lost, you know, her crush, this romantic story, but Layla lost a brother, you know, and it's much harder. Somebody that she really knew well, who was like, you know, the other side of the coin, you know, Layla and Armin, very, very similar. So again, there's this difference between this experience, you know, him going missing. So yeah, I wanted him to be this kind of dark center in the story. And then Sarah is kind of moved by him, like he's the principal motive for her. But I wanted her by the end of the book to realize that the story was actually not about him, that the story was actually about Layla, that it was Layla, you know, who was the real protagonist of the story and the real reason that she went on this trip. So this was kind of the learning curve that I wanted for Sarah. Sorry, I'm going on and on.
No. It's interesting to hear you talk about it. It's making me think of a book that I read earlier this year and an author that I talked to. It's nonfiction, but it's called Certain and Impossible Events. I hope I'm not botching that with my terrible memory, but it's by Candace Jane Opper. And it's a memoir and kind of reads like a mystery, but it's about a boy that she had a huge crush on in junior high who committed suicide. Like they were in band together. They played instruments and, you know, he was this like fantastic musician. Apparently he was like really good at the saxophone and she just had this like huge crush on him, but never consummated, never told him about it. He had no idea. And then he committed suicide, I want to say a week after Kurt Cobain. Wow. And she spent the next like 30 years essentially writing this book. Cause he was frozen in her. It's like that obsession. It's like, I think the reason it came to mind is because you're talking about Armin and how Sarah has this obsession with him and how she weighs every male relationship that she has or intimate relationship she has against that ideal. Exactly. And that ideal is fixed because he disappeared. she never got to see him age into a frumpy, ornery, middle-aged man, you know, like, or whatever.
No, I mean, she barely had any contact with him, really. So he was just this really useful vessel to just fill with whatever dreams and ideas she had about him. This is also something that I really loved in that James Joyce story, The Dead, where, you know, there's the young lover who died, and then there's the husband. and this is very much autobiographical when it comes to Joyce. But, you know, there's this feeling of, I can never come close to that young boy singing under your window, you know, in the rain, whatever, because he died. So what you said, you know, it's fixed. I'm the husband. I'm the one you're going to see in the morning, you know. You're going to see.
You don't want to hear me sing anywhere, let alone under your window. That's a...
Exactly. So he was, you know, he kind of, the Gabriel in the story becomes, and Joyce himself becomes, like, obsessed with this figure, like, jealous. But what are you really jealous of? Like, what is it? So I was also interested in this, you know, this kind of person who's not really, it's probably, if we had Layla tell us the story and describe Armin, he would be completely different. You know, he would be probably the annoying older brother who has a lot of, like, you know, things that she doesn't like, or the, whatever. But we don't get that. We just get this 16-year-old god artist. Maybe he wasn't even that good at it. We don't know. Like, to Sarah, he's just perfect, right?
Yeah, to me, I consider Armin a heartthrob after reading your book. I have a crush on him, for God's sake.
Exactly, yeah. So then, you know, to have him go missing, that kind of gives a whole different dimension to the story.
So I want to track your biography a little bit more, just because you've been so many different places, and it's unique, you know, the how well traveled you are and how itinerant.
Not really. So, I've never been to the States.
Well, come on over. Well, what better time?
There's this thing, I don't know if you've noticed, this global pandemics.
Oh, right. well, whenever that, you know, eventually subsides, you know, and we get back to some semblance of ordinary, you should hopefully come over and do some kind of tour. I don't know if book tours are going to be as much of a thing as they once were. I hope they come back.
I would love to. It was so sad to have my book come out in, you know, the middle of all this.
Yeah. I've been doing all of these.
But everybody's gone through it. Yeah.
I used to only do this show in person. I used to insist on it, which limited my pool of interviewees, because not everybody was coming through Los Angeles, but it was just more compelling. It's gotten better, I guess, as technology's gotten better. I find that I'm able to do it just fine. I mean, the pandemic forced my hand.
Yeah, exactly.
But I think
I'm just tired of seeing, you know, upper halves of people.
Right.
I miss seeing feet and shoes.
What kind of shoes are we wearing now? I've got my running shoes on. They're not that impressive, but anyhow, I want to ask you about, you know, you said you majored in English, meaning like English literature, or did you study the language?
It was, the program was called English Language and Literature.
Okay. So you're learning to be fluent in English, and you're also reading James Joyce, right?
Yeah, kind of.
Okay. And where did you do this?
So I did my bachelor's degree in Banja Luka in Bosnia. And then I moved to Belgrade to do my master's. But actually, we didn't read a lot of Joyce. I remember one day this professor, this kind of weird professor, everybody has a weird professor, he kind of showed up in class and he said, I'm supposed to talk, you know, to talk to you about Joyce, but I haven't read Ulysses. I don't want to read it. I don't want to read Finnegan's Wake. If you want to go there, whatever, I'm not going there. And I was like, what is it with this book, you know, that, you know, a university professor is, you know, bragging about not wanting to read it. So I kind of went to it on my own. And I think it was when it comes to my literary education, it was the books that I found on my own that had more influence on me as a writer than, you know, what I read. Of course, you know, you, when you study English literature, you read a lot of, you know, Dickens and you know, George Eliot and Jane Austen and the Brontes and great, great writers. But it was what I found later that really kind of got me hooked. So yeah, I did that, and then I had two BAs and a master's degree, and I couldn't get a job in Bosnia. I was a waitress for a while, then like the best I could hope for was a secretary, and I was depressed. I was really sad. I just felt stuck and paralyzed. So I decided, okay, I'm leaving. What can I do? Well, I can maybe teach English, you know. So I went to Prague to get this international certificate for English teachers, and that was like the start of my kind of moving around and just traveling and yeah.
So where have you been, all told? I mean, I feel like you've spent some time in Ireland. Is that incorrect?
No, I haven't. I mean, I have visited, but I never lived there. And that was a mistake that my agent made. He, for some reason, saw that I lived in Ireland. I think he saw me as Sarah, or saw Sarah as me, I don't know. And
well, that's what I was doing. That's what I was doing. I was like, oh, she must have lived in Dublin at some point. But no.
Oh, God, no. When the book came out in German, there was this biography in the first edition. It said, you know, after the war, Lana moved to Dublin. And she lived there for, I was like, wow, this is incredible. I've been there, obviously, but I've never lived there. I chose Dublin for, you know, Sarah's dwelling because of this connection with Joyce, and because, you know, for me, Sarah's escape is physical, it's to Ireland, and my escape was kind of to literature. You know, I just decided I'm going to ignore this, you know, war, childhood, Bosnia, my language, everything, and I'm just going to study the English modernists, and, you know, I'm going to get into Ulysses. And I did it for like, it was like 10 years of my life I just spent, you know, with with this. I even taught a class in Barcelona about Joyce. You know, that was my escape. So I thought I wanted to show it in the book, you know, like just to that I also spent a lot of time figuratively in Dublin.
So, you've read Ulysses and you've read Finnegan's Wake cover to
Nobody
cover.
Nobody has read Finnegan's Wake.
I was going to
say James Joyce.
I got to say, like, I've tried to read Ulysses and I've picked up Finnegan's Wake, and I have not yet been able to go all the way through. It's been a while, so maybe I've matured or something. But you've read Ulysses,
well,
and it.
I think now really there's no excuse, because there's a lot of stuff on the internet that can help you. The thing is, you know, a lot of people, like, they come to a book wanting it to be one thing, to do one thing. And books are just another medium, and each book is going to do something different. You know, one is going to be entertaining, you're going to take it to the beach. The other one is going to be a journey that, for me, it was like a lot of years. And I love puzzles, and I love books that take me to other books. And, you know, okay, now I have to go and read Dante. And then once I'm done, then I come back. And so I love this, you know. To me, this is, to some people it isn't, and I respect that, you know, it's fine. But it was definitely worth it. And once you, you know, get into it, I think you either never get into it or you never get out, because like there's always more to find and discover, and there's a great Joycean community, just basically a community of mad people. and now I met a 93-year-old man who runs the James Joyce Foundation in Zurich, because that's where Joyce died. And he's like my best friend in Switzerland, you know, and when I appeared there at the foundation, he like saw me and he was like, what is this young person who looks like she has a life doing here. And then we really connected. So it really feels like a family, you know. You can meet somebody from across the world and just quote something from Ulysses, and it's like
That's
instant
it.
connection. So yeah,
Yeah.
I really recommend it, but I also know it's not for everyone. I'm sad that it's seen as this elitist thing, you know, academic, intellect, when actually it's so much fun. It's the first novel in, you know, the history of literature where you have the main character take a crap. You know,
What could
I
be
mean,
better?
it's so much more than just, you know, elitist, academic, whatever, scholarly text. It's really a lot of fun.
All right. You're selling me. I'll have to give it another shot. I think
I'm better at selling Joyce than at selling my own book.
Right. He could use a publicist, frankly. I think he, you know, he needs a little boost.
Yeah.
So you go to Barcelona, you're teaching English, you were in Prague. Now you're in Zurich. Is there any place else we're missing that you've been and lived?
Zagreb, on
All
and
right.
off. Yeah, but that's a very strange thing because I was born there, but I didn't grow up there. And so my dialect is different. So when I go there, at the same time, I'm in my hometown and I'm somebody else. Like I'm an outsider, you know? So that's really strange, but I love Zagreb. I love being there. And yeah, I mean, I usually go to these residencies and they can take from, you know, one month to 6 months or 1 year. So lately I've just been kind of going around
That sounds great.
Tuscany and then Serbia, back to Serbia. Sarajevo, I did the residency there. I love Sarajevo. And now Zurich. So I'm hoping to go to Berlin. So I'm kind of sticking to Europe. I would like to explore other continents.
But I feel like Europe is maybe friendlier to the artist. I mean, I know like America has residencies and I mean, these things exist, but I just feel like maybe the stipends are more generous or there's a higher volume or something. Maybe too, the proximity of nations, you just have more options because they're all bunched up together in a relatively, you know, close proximity geographically. But if you
yeah,
can pull it off, it's great. I mean, you get to go experience these different cultures. You're able to live someplace. That sounds ideal kind of for a writer.
Yeah, but then it can also, you know, I don't know. I mean, I wrote this novel in Barcelona. I was working as an English teacher. I had like really, it was quite a rough time because I had to take the bus and then the train and then another bus to get to work. And I would come home at 11 p.m. and completely exhausted. And then I would sit down to write. So I wrote the book. Yeah, I would eat, you know, have dinner or something. And then I would be writing till 3 or 4 a.m. So yeah, sleep disorders, all of those things. And that's when I wrote this novel, you know. And now actually I'm in this residency, this perfect place, you know, to write. I just need to be writing. I'm here. I have the place. I have, you know, this scholarship, whatever. And I'm really struggling with writer's block. So I don't know. I don't know what's better. I mean, I just don't want our listeners to think, yeah, I need to get a residency in order to write my book. Like, that's an excuse.
Right. If you're not in Tuscany on an idyllic pastoral, you know, campus where you're looking out of a window over, you know, rolling fields, there's no way that novel's getting done. But I relate to that. I think sometimes the more we have to do, the more productive we are. And if we have too much downtime, you know, I don't know what it is. Maybe like, were you drinking a lot of caffeine? You must have been.
There was a lot of caffeine. There was, I mean, and everything was going on. It was really tough, but I had it so clear in my head that, you know, there was no prep time. Like, I would sit down and I knew exactly where I left off. I knew exactly where I was going. So this is why it's good to have an outline. You know, you sit down and you work. There's no like sitting around waiting for ideas or inspiration or whatever. So that's one good piece of advice. Have an outline. I know it doesn't sound romantic, but You know, it's going to help you. If you only have 1 hour, well, you know what you're going to do in that hour. So in that way, it was really, really helpful.
Well, and even if you deviate from the outline, like it's not
exactly.
like you don't have to adhere to every last letter of it, but at least it gives you a framework, you know?
Exactly. Definitely. Definitely. I mean, there's some, at least one chapter is complete. I've rewrote it from scratch. It's completely different from what I had in mind. So, I don't think you should just stick to it, you know, for the sake of it, because the story is going to kind of tell you, no, I want to go here, you know, explore that. And if the story is telling you that, probably the reader is going to feel the same way. So you should go there. But just having some sort of idea of I'm working on this, you know, I was kind of connected to it, even though, you know, I could be teaching, I could be doing whatever, you know, correcting exams, explaining past simple tense or whatever,
yeah.
to Spaniards, but like I was connected to it, you know, it was constantly there. And then it was easy to tune in and just keep going.
Wow. Well, it worked out. I'm doubly impressed now that you wrote this in the throes of sleep deprivation. But then again, you were living in Spain where everybody eats dinner at 11 o'clock at night anyway.
That's
so there's,
true. Yeah.
Yeah. So you were within
but
the
I
normal
don't
frame.
Recommend it.
Were you taking a siesta? Were you engaging in that too? Like you?
No, I mean, it was a really strange time, like personally, professionally. And, you know, at that point I had no agent, I had no publisher. And I think that helped too. Like nobody knew that I was writing. Nobody even knew that I was a writer in that city, you know, except for my partner, but like nobody really had any idea. So I didn't feel like, you know, anybody was expecting this. I think it was Paul Auster who said a really good line. He said, "The world doesn't owe you anything." You know, and that was such a great piece of advice. Like, yeah, nobody cares. Nobody cares. Nobody's waiting, you know, not sleeping because Lana Bastashich is writing a novel. Nobody cares. I'm
right.
just like doing this because I want to tell this story. And it was easier because of that. Now that I have, you know, a book deal, an agent, a publisher, now it's much different. Now it's like, okay,
and
now I can actually.
And the winner of the 2020 European Union Prize for Literature.
Yeah,
also...
that doesn't help.
Yeah, so now the stakes are raised, you know, like
yeah.
It's an award-winning published author, translated, multiple languages. Like, I guess this leads to the natural question of what are you working on? Like, what's your next book? You're working on it right now in Zurich.
Yeah, well, the thing is that I did publish a short collection of short stories, short collection of short stories in between. Because this book, the Catch the Rabbit, came out in the original language in 2018. So for me, it's been like a while in a way. And I decided to go back to some short stories that I was writing about childhood trauma with children as protagonists. And that book came out recently in Zagreb and Belgrade. And I was just happy to, you know, work on something else. And I think short stories are a great bridge between two novels because you're kind of, you know, developing your craft, your work, you're not getting too attached. You're just kind of, you know, working on each little stone in a way in your workshop and kind of also getting, you know, cleaning your mind and your style from that voice of that book, because I think there is a difference between style and voice. I think a lot of writers confuse that. And I don't want to repeat myself. You know, I don't want Sarah to write another book. I want to write another book. And I want it to have its own voice. You know, writing short stories helped me kind of get rid of Sarah and move elsewhere. And I'm not going to tell you where, because I think I'm going to jinx it if I tell you what I'm working on.
That's fair. That's fair. I won't press you. I understand the superstitions that writers have, and I think it's important to honor them. But I think it's worth following up a little bit on this idea of writing short stories as kind of a palate cleanser. I don't know if I've heard somebody say it exactly that way, but it makes some sense to me. And on a related note, I think of what you just said about the zone that you were in when you were writing Catch the Rabbit, even amid all this tumult, you know, and the difficult work schedule and everything in Barcelona. you had a sense of focus that I think is common to the story of every book ever written. And it's like a feeling that you're chasing. It's a wonderful mode to be in a lot of ways, especially when you're not in it. I have lived both experiences, one far more than the other, but there is a joy to being in the depths of working on a book and having a real sense of mission and clarity about what you're doing. Even if it's hard work, it's nice to get up and go face the blank page and have a sense of directionality. I guess there's not any way to tie it up in a bow, but I'm going to posit something and I just would love to hear you respond to it. But it's this notion of if we're going to follow this idea of writing short stories in between novels as a way of sort of cleaning out the wires or whatever and divesting yourself of the voice of your previous book. I think, too, when you're working on stories and you're working in miniature, it's allowing you to test out characters and other voices and themes, like you say, without getting too bogged down or spending too much time there. And I think if you're working on a novel, it's a much bigger canvas, obviously. And there is a synergy that has to happen, or that feels like it happens in good books when you're reading them, where, you know, the author is in command of the whole world of the thing and all the different moving pieces of the puzzle, all the machinery inside of it, you know, the unseen machinery inside of it. That's a place that you have to arrive at after usually a lot of failure. You know, it's a lot of false starts. It's a lot of trial and error, multiple drafts, lost chat, all that kind of stuff. Or you're hacking away at the outline for 6 months just to get your head wrapped around it. But I guess the point that I'm trying to make is that, like, not only is it a way of divesting yourself of the previous narrator and the previous voice so that you can get to something new, but it's like initiating that process of assembling all those various forces that you're going to need to bring to bear on the next big story.
Yeah, totally. I mean, it's good. It's kind of a good reminder that it's work. You know, for me, like I love short stories. I think I would be writing more short stories if, you know, the market was different. It just reminds me, okay, I have a very small canvas and I don't get to, you know, explore one plot line, the other one. I'm just trying to do this one little thing. And you really feel like it's, you know, working. You're in a workshop and you're just, you know, doing hard work, and you kind of fall out of love with yourself in a way. But for me, it was also useful with every, you know, short story to think about the themes that I want to explore more, that I'm to realize what is it that really interests me, not what I, you know, want to be interested in, but something that's real, that I keep going back to. What is it? What is it? What is it? And I like to, if I can put it into one word or a sentence, then I kind of have it, you know, just like not the plot, not just what's this. I like to call it the center. Like, what's the center of the story? What are you? So writing this collection, I realized that, okay, there's a lot of trauma. There's this and there's that. And then I realized I want to write about nostalgia. I'm interested in nostalgia. You know, that's like, but it took a long time to get there and to realize this will probably be the center of my next novel. I still don't have all the details figured out, but I have that, you know, and then everything is kind of easier. I think that's also a good tip for any writers who might be listening. Like, just figure out what it is that you want to tell. Like, what is that thing? You know, maybe you think it's a love story and it's not a love story at all, you know?
This is what's so crazy. It's like maddening and hilarious at the same time, how mysterious we can be to ourselves. You would think that if something is this important to us and is in there buried deep, that it would be more accessible. And yet we have to sit there and like peel away the layers and go through all this trial and error just to get to the point where we can write a sentence and go, oh, so that's what I'm fixated on. Like, we're so good at hiding from ourselves. We don't even realize it.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, you were talking about a writer being in command of the book, but I think like, More often, it's the books that are in command of us somehow.
Right, right.
And then you have to struggle. I do think that if it is a battle between the writer and the story, I think the story has to win. And the writer has to just let go of, you know, his or her ego and say, okay, this is where the story is. You know, I think this is interesting because it happened to me, or my grandpa told me this, or whatever. No, but your story is actually here. There's a great anecdote, and I'm not going to keep you any longer, but the story of To Kill a Mockingbird, which apparently the first draft was completely different. And it was the editor who told Harper Lee, this is not where your story is. This the actual story of the meat of this book is here. Should go here.
Do you know what was the shift? Was it like making it Scout's story? Was it like a shift in, was it taking it out of Atticus?
I think it was that, and also kind of giving more stage time to Atticus and the whole thing. But I mean, you should check this. I can't remember the exact details, but I remember reading that it was actually the editor who said, your story is here. And then, you know, Harper Lee went back and she rewrote the book. And obviously it was the right choice. Now it's a great American classic, you know, but this is sometimes we tend to cling to our initial idea. Like, no, but I wanted to write this huge novel, you know, huge historical novel about Bosnia, starting with the Ottoman Empire and the killing of the Austrian prince. And no, but maybe you just want to talk about, you know, growing up a little girl in this town, this short, and that's, you know, it's so, you know, it's not healthy to cling onto this one idea. Just let your story show you, you know, where it wants to go.
I think that's wise advice. And I think sometimes too, it's like, you know, the personal is universal, or, you know, you can think you have to work on some grand scale in order to say something deeply meaningful, and a lot of times it's the opposite that's true. You know, you try to approach things like, you know, covering millennia and, you know, making some sort of like omniscient proclamation about human nature or whatever, and, you know, you're much better off telling the story of a road trip with two, you know, estranged but deeply connected friends.
Well, you know? now I feel a bit, you know, arrogant giving all this advice after
That's all
one
right.
novel, but it's just because I think, you know, since I went through it, like I wish somebody had told me this, and probably, you know, maybe with the next book I fail completely and I write a really bad book, and that's fine, you know. I mean, there are some writers that I love, like, for example, I love Julian Barnes, but there are some of his books that I just don't really care for, and then there are others that I love. So it's like, you know, I realize, like, that's fine, you know. It's not like you are a writer. It's like you write a good book, you write a bad book, it's fine. So yeah, I don't want to come off as this arrogant, okay, now I will, you know, follow me, I will show you the way. It just some sort of things that I think maybe would be helpful to other writers.
Well, and I think too, you know, I say things like that all the time, and I'm mostly talking to myself. You know, it's just things you realize either along the way or you're kind of reflecting on after the fact. But
it's like, you know, that moment when you give a TED talk to yourself in the back, you know, complete with the.
I don't know what you're talking about. I don't know what you're talking about. I would never do such a thing. But, you know, you talk about writers, and, you know, maybe you write a good book, maybe you write a bad book. I mean, look at Harper Lee. I mean, she wrote that one book, really. I mean, I know there was the sequel or whatever, but there's some controversy around its publication. But to me, she kind of is she's like the ultimate story of that writer who writes that one masterpiece.
Yeah.
And one of the great, like, sort of sideline stories that I love about that book is the fact that she had these rich friends in New York who financed her for a year. Did you know this?
Well, I knew that she had rich friends. I didn't know that they financed her for a year.
They gave her I want to say it was like a Christmas present or a birthday present. And she opens the envelope and it's like, we're going to pay for your life for a year, write your novel. And what I don't know is, like, did they get a cut of the royalties on this thing? Like, talk about a great investment. If you're going to finance a novel to be written, at least you financed an American classic, you know, like.
Yeah.
That's pretty cool. Like, it's a kind of a nice story of like creative midwifery and like a good deed, you know?
Doesn't really happen anymore.
Not enough, right? I feel like there
Maybe
needs
we
to
just
be.
have terrible friends.
I definitely need some new friends. That's for sure. I think as do most
Any
of all of us.
millionaires listening to us now,
Yeah,
you can
please.
contact us.
I'll try my best to write a classic. And hey, you know, who knows how this all shakes out, but I feel like Catch the Rabbit has found a readership, you know, across borders and is receiving a lot of glowing praise. Like, maybe you've written a book that's going to keep being read. I think you might have done it. It's a lovely novel. I really enjoyed reading it. It taught me a lot, and I'm excited to see what you come up with next. And I hope that at some point, you know, when book tours are happening, you make your way over to the States and you get to see the chaos up close.
Definitely. Well, thanks for reading, and thanks for such an interesting discussion. A lot of questions that I haven't heard before, and it's been 3 years, so that's always nice.
A lot of questions you hope to never hear again, you know, like.
No, but I'm definitely looking forward to coming, you know, across the ocean into the land of chaos.
Yes.
And see what I can get there. Yeah, maybe some new book comes out of that chaos. Who knows?
Okay, you guys, there you have it. That is Lana Bastashich. And her debut novel is called Catch the Rabbit. It is available now in translation from Restless Books. It is the official June pick of the Nervous Breakdown Book Club. You can find Lana Bastashich online at lanabastashich.com. You can also track her down on Instagram. I believe her handle over there is at lanabasta. Once again, the novel is called Catch the Rabbit, available now from Restless Books. Go get your copy. The Other People podcast is offered freely. All episodes, more than 700 and counting. The entire archive is made available to you for free. It's a listener-supported show. If you like this program, if you get something from it, if you listen regularly, and if you have the means, support the show. Tip your server. Just go to patreon.com/otherpplpod. patreon.com/otherpplpod. There are different tiers, different levels of support. For as little as, what is it, $2 a month, $1 a month, you can support the show. And then there are higher tiers. You can get stuff, a tote bag, a coffee mug, a t-shirt. I will wish you a happy birthday. I'll write you a postcard. Come on. patreon.com/otherpplpod. The Other People podcast lives online at otherppl.com. You can also listen to it on Spotify, Stitcher, Apple Podcasts, wherever you get your shows. The program also has its own official app, the Other People with Brad Listy app. It, too, is free. Go get the app. If you have something to say, if you would like to write to me, the email address for the show is letters@otherppl.com. letters@otherppl.com. Let me know what you think. The Other People podcast is also now on YouTube. It has its own official YouTube channel. Every episode's up on YouTube. Check that out. Next week, I'll be talking with Forrest Gander, Pulitzer Prize-winning poet Forrest Gander. You're in for a treat. Had a good time with him. Okay?